And I think that it's important because social media paints this picture that, and I know this because people have made comments to me in the past that I lived this charmed life of international travel and success and, all of the qualifications and the things I get to do and the projects I get to work on and the opportunities that come my way. But the reality is that I have as much self-doubt as the next person, and I struggle with it immensely sometimes. I sometimes feel like I'm not good enough to be doing what I'm doing, and that somewhere along the line someone's going to work out that I don't deserve to be where I am or doing what I'm doing. And it's something that I have to. There's a lot of self-talk that I have to do. I probably am my hardest critic.
Hi, my name is Jared. I'm your attitude coach, and here we are for episode number 7 of the Attitude Series podcast. I'm super excited, but you know what? I think I say this every time. I'm always excited. I've got Gemma Parandare here, and we're gonna get into some detail with Gemma. Really dynamic lady. She's done a tremendous amount of stuff in terms of, I want to say, she's all about the environment. She's about the oceans, but it's not even that. She's got a whole history that we're going to probably dive into a little bit, and we'll let her talk more about it. But we're excited to have her here. Tough to get this lady in, by the way. Very tough to get her in and to get her on time, which is even more challenging. So without further ado, let's get excited. Hey, Gemma, thanks for joining us.
No worries. Thank you.
How you doing today?
Yeah, great. Been a busy day.
It has
and
been.
I'm sorry I'm late.
No, it's quite all right. It's quite all right. I want to know what was holding you up.
I was volunteering at the Mountain Goat Trail and a Surefoot race this morning.
Yeah.
Did a bit of a run myself. And then I really had to go home and have a shower because it was a warm day out there and you didn't want me in this room.
Right. Right.
Stinking. So... yeah, that's what helped me up.
So those are your local, that's your local crew that you run with.
That's my crew. That's my herd. Yeah.
That's your herd. I love it. Everybody's got to have a tribe. And who are these guys again?
Mountain Goat Trail Runners. So they're a group of misfits.
Yeah.
I think you quite happily say a bunch of misfits that started up a trail running club. Well, I guess it's almost 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago now. And I've been running them ever since day one. And they're just crazy and they don't care. So they're my kind of people.
Yeah, they are. They are pretty cool. I had a chance. I was there obviously today, ran. But yeah, you're right. They're a cool bunch of guys and girls. And yeah, this is a plug for those guys too, by the way. So if anybody happens to see it from the Mountain Goats, you guys, obviously this is a plug for you guys. Maybe we can boost your membership. If you need more members, I don't know. Maybe they don't.
Hey, we always welcome new people, for sure.
Yeah.
You just gotta, there's a couple of rules you gotta follow. You can't be a douche. That's one of our rules.
Okay.
a penchant for beer drinking also goes down well. It's not mandatory, but we do enjoy a few beverages after, sometimes before a run.
Wow.
And you gotta be able to deal with the banter because we like to run hills and we like to be mean to each other.
Right. I won't give out any initials, but Travis Bell, isn't he one of those guys?
He certainly is.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Has anybody, by the way, when you said you can't be a douche, has anybody been thrown out of the club?
No one's been thrown out.
Asked to leave?
People leave of their own accord if the goats are not for them, I think. And we're probably a bit like Vegemite, a bit of an acquired taste. And awesome. We're pretty sadistic, definitely like running up very steep hills.
Cool.
So if people come and they can't deal with that, then they tend to just depart.
Game over, man. Well, I will say this for any locals that really want to get into it, Mountain Goats, the race they had on today, the Surefoot, 21 kilometers, over 1,000 meters of elevation around Mount Cutha. I spoke to some people that came up from the Gold Coast. It was quite funny because I know those trails quite intimately. And I knew, like, when you get to the top, I knew turns, I knew all that stuff, even though I wasn't moving that fast. And I had a few guys that were like, oh, God, how long is this hill going to go on? I was like, actually, another 150 meters, take a right, and we're going to be hitting the road. And they're like, really? And then all of a sudden, you see them pick up their pace, get around there. Like, yeah. But, yeah, very challenging course today. Very challenging course. Anybody that completed it, kudos to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great day, though.
Was a great day. So let's kick off. I'd really like to know if we could back up a little bit. Just a little bit, and we can, because before we get into the whole research scientist and the oceans and the making a difference, because there's some really cool things that I know that you can share with our wider audience, I want to know a little bit more about Gemma and growing up. Where did you grow up? Because you're not Australian, are you?
No, well, I'm now an Australian citizen. Yeah, have been for a few years.
Put it there.
Thanks.
Hey!
They
let us in.
Yeah, they did. They let me stay, which was really nice. This is a bit of a surprise. I grew up in the UK in the southwest of England.
Okay.
The county called Dorset, for anybody who knows England intimately.
Is that a rough place?
No.
No.
Quite.
Is that a posh place?
It's sunny posh.
Yeah?
Yeah, It's pretty quiet. It's rural. It's your typical rolling green hills and ancient forests and thatched cottages and freezing cold but epic surf. You know, so yeah,
you're painting a whole different picture from what I would think. You know?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So it was a pretty awesome place to grow up in the middle of nature and just freedom, and just got to enjoy. Enjoy cruising around with my sister and on our bikes, push bikes on the weekend with no worries and
awesome,
no restrictions. So yeah, it was a pretty nice upbringing, I'd say.
So was that in terms of family? So you got a sister, but
yep.
And you guys were always encouraged to be out and about.
Yeah,
thing?
Yeah, yeah. We didn't. I mean, we weren't big TV watchers. Like, we watched a little bit of TV, but we didn't watch a lot of TV and. We were encouraged to be outside, and our favourite thing when the weather was reasonable, which, you know, UK, it's not always that great, was going out on our bikes, and we just loved it. I just have most of my really happy memories is being out on my bike with my sister. And also we did a lot of like make-believe type play, and a lot of that was always, we used to pack little backpacks and pretend that the stairs from the hallway up to the first floor were Mount Everest, and we were mountaineers, and we'd be climbing the stairs or the mountain. And then my mum would set up a clothes horse, like a clothes dryer in the backyard with a blanket over it, and we'd be on safari in Africa, you know?
Right.
So, like, lots of imaginative play and adventures like in our own backyard type things.
Now, was this always brought upon by yourself or your sister? Who had who was more creative, or who started this?
I'd say my sister is way more creative than I am, but my mum actually. So my mum is super creative. She's quite an artist,
okay.
Even though that's not what her profession is, and that was never something she really did. That much of she's incredibly creative.
Was she strict at all?
I wouldn't say she was strict. She was fair. So we were disciplined. My father was strict.
I like that word, discipline. What is that? What was that like? If discipline?
We weren't allowed to get away with stuff. You know. So if she, especially as we were as we became teenagers, and you know, we were both, you know, running off and doing things and. You know, smoking and drinking and all the rest of it that you do when you're a horrible teenager. And my mum knew every single thing we were up to. There was no, even though we thought we were being really crafty and she'd had no idea that we'd been out smoking, you know, or drinking or something, she knew.
Are we talking cigarettes or weed?
I was a cigarette smoker. Probably my sister was a bit more on the weed.
Right.
Yeah, I was, I never really did drugs. I was never a drug taker, but yeah, I used to like to get drunk with my friends when I was in my teens, and mum always knew, and she would never yell at us. She would never punishes, but she would use the D word, the I'm disappointed in you, which would just crush your soul. So she knew exactly how to hit us where it hurt and make us behave.
That's
without being strict, you know?
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah. That works well. How would a dad handle you all?
My dad didn't probably really handle my sister and I. I think he was a very hands-off parent. He didn't really, I think he was very much a babies kind of a guy. And then as soon as we got a bit too old for, you know, and started talking back, and I have always been pretty bad at talking back.
Right.
Or good. Whichever way.
Oh, you mean like you know, if somebody gives it to you, you're ready to get back?
It's straight back at you. Yeah. I have never been a wallflower. So as soon as I was old enough to answer back, then I was answering back, and he just, he was not keen on
where
that.
Where did that strategy come from?
I think a lot of it is my personality. I am the family extrovert. So the majority of my family are introverted, relatively quiet people, and I don't know, something happened, maybe lack of oxygen or something when I was born, but I'm the family extrovert. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then, you know, we're moving on into those teenage years going in, and then when did all of a sudden, where did I guess you went and started doing your education.
Yeah.
Got excited about, hey, listen, I've got a bit of a purpose here.
I think it took me a bit of time to find my purpose, but I was very fortunate in that my parents prioritized my education. So we, as a family, we went without a lot of things. We didn't have a flashy house or a fancy car. We didn't go on big family holidays, and my parents put everything towards mine and my sister's education. So we went to private schools and had the best education that they could afford. And that, I think, on its own gives you direction, you know. Like I was always very grateful for that. The alternative would have been to have gone to our local state school, which was not a good school. There was a lot of social problems at state schools in the UK, I'd say, and particularly our local state school. And so I was very grateful for my parents making the sacrifices. So I think when you are aware of that, you want to do something good.
I like how you just said that. The fact that your parents made sacrifices, you're grateful for them, and as a result, this is how you progressed, you know, because I think about kids today.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how much impact or how much you see with kids today, but I think I come from that same line where you see your parents have made sacrifices to help you get to a certain point.
Yeah.
You know, my dad, I remember years ago, my dad said to me, he goes, there's only two things you can give your kids. Love and education.
That's really profound. But I totally agree.
Oh, and I mean, I still remember, you know, I could probably go on about what I was thinking about just then. But I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And that the fact that you were aware that they were making sacrifices for you, and now you can still, you got to be grateful about stuff.
Oh,
you got to be grateful.
Absolutely. And I, you know, neither of my parents came from wealthy backgrounds. In fact, they were from quite poor families, and they both worked incredibly hard to be able to succeed. And, you know, in the UK in particular, and in India as well. My dad's from India, by the way. That's the Parandare part of
the Parandarays. Yeah, I love it.
And, you know, my mum in particular didn't have any opportunities. She didn't come from a family that was educated or had even ever finished school. So she left school at 15, and back in those days, you could do a nursing apprenticeship, and she went and did that from about the age of 16 onwards, and then did her degree when I was a small child, and then her postgraduate qualification she did when I was, I think I must have been just about 11 years old or around then.
Wow.
When she did that. And so, you know, you see, and she did that whilst bringing up two small children and working. She would work 12-hour days, my mum, you know. And with not a lot of help from my dad, who was also working full time and working relatively long hours as well. So I think when you grow up in a family of people who have come from nothing, have transcended class, if you like, and the class system is still alive and well in the UK, and had actually were being successful themselves and were achieving themselves, you know, that rubs off on you as a child. You see the value of hard work, and you can see that. And the one thing, even though my father and I have never really gotten along, but the one thing that he did always say to me was, you can do anything you want if you only work hard enough.
That's right.
And that's probably the one thing I've always taken from the few things that he's said to me over the years, anybody can do anything. You don't have to be super gifted or really like intelligent or a born athlete. If you put the hard work in, you can achieve something. And that's something that I've always, has always stuck with me, particularly as I've gotten older, that, you know, if I really want to achieve the things I want to achieve, then I've just got to work damn hard.
You're bloody persistent, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that's no secret. I'm pretty stubborn, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I could sense, I totally sense that. There was a race a few years ago that called the Hillary in New Zealand, and I didn't complete it. I didn't finish that race. I know you went the following year and you totally crushed it.
Well, it crushed me in the process.
But you crushed it.
That was a classic case of Gemma didn't train enough for a race, which happens every now and again. And I went into the Hillary completely underestimating it. And, you know, I think with trail running or any kind of endurance sport, if you don't respect the race, then you deserve everything you get.
You deserve an ass whooping,
yeah,
right?
And I got an absolute ass whooping. Yeah. I did finish that race, though. It was a big day.
Yeah.
And I think I cried a few times.
I think it's a race you can cry. So mom and dad, are they still around?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Yep. And you're still in communication with both of them?
Yep, absolutely. My mom is probably, it sounds a bit of a cliche, but she's probably my best friend.
Cool.
We talk almost daily via WhatsApp and try and talk on the phone as often as we can. And they're both still living in the UK. I'm the only one who chuffed off, and I see my mum twice a year at least, so we spend not a huge amount of time together, but really good quality time together. Probably about if you add it up, it's probably about 6 weeks a year, or 6 to 8 weeks a year we spend together, and it's like really good quality time.
Where's sister at?
She's still in the UK as well. She lives with her fiance, not too far from where we grew up, in a really beautiful part of the country, and they have a really nice house that they spend a lot of time renovating and making a beautiful home, and so she's pretty
awesome.
Happy. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, where did and I won't dive into it just yet, but a couple things that I know that you are pretty passionate about, and thanks, by the way, for sharing your bit of your childhood and
no worries.
The Paranderes story. Love it. The Paranderes. So one of the things that you're super passionate about, and I've seen some of your posts. I've actually seen you. I was going to say this to you before we got started, was I've seen pictures of you educating young kids in a classroom. They could have been like grade four, as far as I'm concerned. They might've been 9, 10, 11 year old kids. Some of the stuff that you do, in particular that you've studied, I was trying to look up these words and understand them because I'm a simple guy. I'm not that. And so I'm thinking, all right, she's obviously good at dealing with kids, so she's going to dumb it down with me, maybe. But making a difference in the world. And obviously that's what you're doing, is you are making a difference. Is that a fair statement?
I would love to hope that I'm making a difference. That's, I think, my sole purpose is to make a difference. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And when you want to pursue something like that for yourself, what are some of the activities that you've been up to, like leading up to some of these things where, you know, like, for example, 2 years ago, I'm talking about the Queensland. Well, it just happened again. It happens every 2 years, that the conference.
Yeah.
Right. And a couple of years ago, you were actually the one that headed that up.
Yeah. Well, actually, that was this year. Yeah. So
as well,
this year I was on the last one I was on the committee for, and this year I was one of the co-chairs for it. Yeah. So
trying to organize it and
it was pretty full on. But organizing a conference.
So that's part of making a difference. What happens at some of these conferences?
Well, if you take the one that just happened this last week, the Queensland Coastal Conference, it's an opportunity for anybody who's working or interested in the field of coastal science or management or beaches or surfing or whatever, to get together and share some knowledge. And that knowledge is often, research that's been done on climate change or on how the ocean is working or how beaches are being eroded or formed or various things like that. And it's an opportunity to understand what other people are doing. And that's one of the most important things in research, is that you actually know what other people are researching.
Right.
And conferences are one way to do that. And then it's also to learn more about things yourself, because I describe myself as somebody who knows a lot about a little. So I don't actually have a huge wealth of knowledge, I don't think. You know, I couldn't tell you. I'm useless with nutrition and diets and all of that kind of stuff. Even as a trail runner, you think I would have, and as a scientist, you think I'd have that down pat, but I've got no idea. I know nothing about medicine, even though my parents are both medics. But I know a lot about marine science,
right?
and that's my field. And so, it's always great to go to those sorts of things, especially you meet people who know a lot more about other things that you don't know anything about, and you get to learn a little bit from them. And also, like, see people, because we only hold that conference every 2 years, people are so busy, you don't get to see each other that often, especially somebody perhaps who's working in Cairns and you're in Brisbane, and you don't get to actually go up to Cairns, or they don't come down to Brisbane all that often, so you get to catch up with people and hang out.
So so this is your chance to extrovert and network.
I suppose so. Yeah
Use your skills to get out there And see what everybody else is doing to make a difference.
Yeah, and I always said that if talking was an international sport, then I would be a gold medalist.
Right.
So I'm pretty good at networking. I enjoy meeting people and learning about who they are and what they do and what drives them. And I love collaborating with people. So
cool.
If I find somebody who has a similar interest but a different perspective, then I love working together with people to come up with ways to do things differently or better or whatever.
Well, I love, you know, like, obviously I've looked, you can find great information on the internet.
Yeah.
Whether it's true or not, but I believe it is, because it's written by yourself, right?
Okay. Well, I would like to think that it's true.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't
I would definitely claim that it's true if I've written it.
Yeah. So some of the things, that I had seen, we're talking about geomorphology. You studied that. Is that something that you deal with at all right now? Is that just
my PhD. I'm just in the process of finishing up my PhD, my doctorate, and that's kind of on geomorphology. Well, it's got geomorphology, and if you don't know what geomorphology is, it's how the Earth changes shape from natural processes. So that could be a river carving a channel into the side of a mountain. That's geomorphology. To the ocean carving the cliffs away. That's also geomorphology. So there's a component of my PhD that's geomorphology.
Well, I guess in some of the stuff that I was looking at and learning and trying to understand about yourself is how much travel that you've done.
Oh, yeah.
Like tremendous travel. A lot. Places that you've been that are phenomenal, like almost, like, how did you get there? You know, when I talk about places in China, we talk about, the Maldives or the Galapagos or some of the really interesting places that you've been to. And I was reading, and maybe this is some of the stuff that you're passionate about too, because it hit me like a ton of bricks, and you can probably answer some of these questions, is you had a trip to Fiji a few years ago.
Yeah.
And you were out on a coastal, out on a reef area. And we're talking about pristine waters, beautiful
amazing
waters. Like, I went to Fiji years ago on a conference trip, and I've been there a few times. But in your trip, talking about how beautiful the waters are, the corals, the reef, all that sort of thing. And some of it was due to the fact that we've got a low tourism issue happening.
Yep.
The fishermen are probably very limited as to what they fish for.
Yep.
And then within a 2-week span, you fly back to Queensland, do a bit of snorkeling around our reefs, and you can't see a meter of there's like less than a meter of visibility. You got dead spots happening, the bleaching that's occurred, things that have gone on, and it's almost like devastating.
Yeah.
To see these effects.
Yep.
You know, is this some of the stuff that you want to?
Yeah.
Combat.
100%. So, I mean, actually, that trip to Fiji, I think, was almost 2 weeks ago, 2 years ago to the week, actually.
Right.
And the thing that made that so unique and that makes Fiji so unique is that they don't have a lot of rivers on some of these smaller islands.
Right.
And a lot of them are still, like, really vegetated. So they're still, like, mostly the forest that always has existed there. There's some areas where they're doing agriculture, but it's pretty small scale. And that particular part of Fiji where I was is not a popular tourist destination. It's not like the west coast of Fiji that a lot of people go to. It was in the far south and just didn't have the volume of people. So some of the main things that impact coral reefs are the stuff that's coming down the rivers into the water. So that could be like sediment or nutrients or whatever from pesticides and fertilizers and, you know, from land clearing and people cutting down trees on their properties. Then damage from tourists, because as much as everybody loves coral reefs and loves to see them, they often kick them and they touch them and they stand on them, and that causes so much damage. And then if you get these big ships that go through, you know, if you get lots of cruise ships or container ships, then ultimately they damage those sorts of reefs as well.
So what is some of the solutions? I mean, I know that you've had over a decade of trying to organize strategies and putting stuff out there, you know, and your resume is super impressive.
Oh, thanks.
I know I haven't sat here and detailed it and outlined it. But it's a very impressive resume to be able to take a look at some of the organizations that you've worked with and the programs that you've put out there, and, you know, just like your negotiation and contracts and everything that you have done. I just think is you're probably humbler right now than you're putting out there. You're just like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to keep it. Yeah, it's all right.
Well, if I think to what I consider my greatest career achievement to date. Back in 2007, I was working in the Maldives for an NGO, and they were a non-for-profit organization who were specifically advocating for the Maldives environment. And one of the things that they were trying to achieve was an area in the far south of the country that was under pressure from development for resorts. And everybody loves to go to the Maldives, and everybody imagines it's paradise and wants to go there and enjoy the resorts and these, you know, like powder white sand and this turquoise water. But the reality is that building a resort means destroying a lot of environment.
Right.
And this area was pristine, and it was this really unique ecosystem that's not commonly found anymore in the Maldives, because their only freshwater source comes from this underground freshwater lens that sits on top of that salt water. So salt water is more dense than freshwater, and that's where they drink that water through and pull it up through bores. And a lot of that water is getting lost because there's so many people now visiting the Maldives, and this area was an environment that was specific to that freshwater lens. So I went there to do an environmental impact assessment and write a report that detailed why that place was special from an environment, marine environment and land environment perspective. And it took me a few months, and I was there for that full time living with communities. I wasn't in a resort, wasn't with tourists. It was a really eye-opening experience. They were going through some political unrest at the time as well.
Wow.
Like,
we're talking upheaval?
Upheaval. Violence and upheaval. So I saw a lot of things that made me grow up very quickly that I think...
And you were right there amongst it.
Yeah, average 20... How old was I at the time? 24, I think. Your average 22-year-old, I think I was 22, doesn't really get to experience, and I saw a lot of things that... I think changed me as a person. And I wrote this report, and it was then used to canvass the government to create a marine protected area, and a protected area for that whole area, which was successful in the end. So I feel like I made a difference because I enabled an area to be protected so that it couldn't be developed. So therefore the environment itself can remain pristine and the local people can enjoy it for, you know, years to come.
Yeah.
And as they always have, it's got huge cultural significance for them. So they don't lose their culture to tourism all the time, you know,
which awesome.
Happens in the Maldives and places like that. Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So being able to do something like that, having a major impact is, that's why I was saying you're this environment warrior that's going out there and doing your thing. In our environment, we obviously have to respect it, you know, where we're at. That's a strong message that you are delivering on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis.
Yeah, look, I think education and knowledge is king, you know. I think the more you understand it, the more you know, the more you can do things. So I've always sought to educate myself, but also to help others understand. I think if people don't understand the why, like, you know, why we should be eating less meat, for example, or why we should be...
Do you buy that one, by the way, why we should be eating less meat?
I think we should be eating less meat.
Right. Yes. Can you take a little divergence from that
Do
one?
Do you want to talk about that a bit more?
I'd love your input. Look, a couple years ago, I went vegetarian.
Yep.
And I think I lasted 2 years. I got into a fight with Nick and the kids, because the day I woke up and I was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. I think I listened to a Rich Roll podcast. And I was like, I got to eat vegetables. Yeah. I got to get off the meat. I got to do. And as soon as that happened, Nick looked at me and she's like, well, what am I supposed to make?
Yeah.
You know, change the whole dynamics of the household. And then I've slowly gone back into being a carnivore. Yeah. And, you know, everybody's got their way. And it's tough because I would prefer, if I go out to a restaurant, I prefer to have, like last night, we had Thai, I had tofu. You know, she had meat, I had tofu. So, you know, it is what it is.
But I think, you know, I mean, I'm a meat eater. I make no apologies for that.
Yeah.
The greatest threat to our planet is the number of people on it. So the more people that are on this planet, and the population is currently at about 7.5 billion people, and it's projected to be over 10 billion people in the next 10 years, which is just exponential, unprecedented growth that we've never seen. The planet can't sustain that many people. It's not a popular conversation topic because people prefer to say, you know, stop eating meat, you know, don't use electricity or whatever. They don't like to talk about population control. And that's the one single thing that would actually
help
us.
So where's that happening right now? Isn't it China? Is population
control? Well, China's one child policy was lifted, I think, about five or ten years ago. So now you can actually have two children in China.
Japan?
No, Japan is one of the most populous countries in the world, actually. In terms of number of people per square meter, that kind of thing. The difficulty is that whether or not you eat meat, and yes, we do need to eat less meat because carbon emissions from meat production are very high. There's still not enough food on this planet to feed everybody even if they went vegetarian or vegan. People like to feel better about their decisions, and the difficulty is there's a lot of bias information out there as well. So if you're making decisions on whether or not to eat meat or to go vegetarian or vegan, and you're looking for information, you're more likely to find a website or information that's been written by somebody who is already, say, a vegan or a vegetarian or somebody who is paleo, let's just say,
right,
you know, any of these choices, and of course is advocating for it. And they're presenting you with the information that supports their argument. And so it's very difficult for people to be informed properly. And I think it's very difficult because there's so much social pressure these days to be doing the right thing. You know, like if I have a group of friends who, if you have a plastic straw in your drink, will pretty much ostracize you.
Right.
And you know, look, like, I don't need a plastic straw. I have a perfectly good mouth and teeth still. So I'm able to drink my drink without a straw. But that's that sort of social pressure is making people resent certain movements or certain activities. So I was talking to somebody about this morning, actually, that this, you know, I'm not against veganism, but there are people out there who are so aggressive and approaching it in such an aggressive manner that it immediately gets people's back up. And as soon as you say, you're a bad person because you eat meat.
You're competing against generations.
Yeah.
Generations. This is information that's been passed on for generations. Yeah.
And it's just not, you know, it's not productive. It's not a productive way to educate people. You know, I believe we need to eat less meat because the science, and I am a scientist, and the science shows us that until we come up with better ways to produce food for people, for the population we have, any kind of mass production of food, whether it's soybeans or for tofu,
right,
or whether it's beef, cattle for you know, your Sunday steak, is bad.
Kind of like, what if we just start taking kids, you know, down to the local farm and say, this is Henry the cow, and this is what we're going to do to prepare him so he can go to market.
Yeah.
And this is how you're going to get your meat, and we start to educate kids that way.
Yeah.
And because it's too easy to walk into a grocery store, absolutely, and go just pick that up. God, even as a kid, I remember my grandfather, who's born in the back hills of Kentucky, they had a farm. They had a farm. They had horses and pigs and cattle and all that. And I remember my grandfather taking my cousins and going down to the back of the red barn and grabbing a rabbit and actually giving this rabbit a thump on the back of the head and then gutting it right there in front of me. As a kid, I was devastated.
Yeah.
I just saw this rabbit and I was like, how cute. Like, you know, yeah, boom. And doing that and those visions, stuff of that nature makes me think, I don't want to. We got some students in the other room that were scared by a spider, and I went and I relocated that spider. I can't even kill a spider. I'm like relocating spiders outside.
Yeah.
So
I don't know.
What's the solution? What's the solution?
Oh, what is the solution? I think it's difficult. I don't think there is one solution. I think that's the key. It's not a case of just making decisions that suit your lifestyle necessarily. I think it's, you know, we need to reconnect with how our food is grown and how it's made, and we need to have a better understanding of how much we need versus how much we want. We need to stop being so materialistic and consumeristic and actually take responsibility for some of our actions, you know, our waste. You know, the amount of stuff, food, you know, packaging, whatever that people waste. You know, the people who get a new iPhone every 2 years or whatever it is.
Right.
You know, that level of waste is what's killing this planet. You know, this constant consumerism. It's the same with food.
Yeah, so that plastic issue. I mean, look, I know I feel like I'm going to jump around here for a second, but all of a sudden I'm thinking plastic, I'm thinking expedition. You just signed up and you're doing this amazing, this might be a little segue, but you're doing this amazing, it's a 2-year around the world. You're one of 300 ladies who's going to be on a ship and you're studying. Anyways, it's kind of exciting. I put a post out. So can you please share a little bit? Expedition?
I'm super excited about Expedition. I think it's an amazing initiative that's come out of the UK. So Expedition is a, like you said, it's a 2-year round the world sailing trip. It's a sailing mission to study the world's oceans and the plastic that's in those oceans. So there's certain spots in the ocean where the ocean currents kind of converge and they create these whirlpools and eddies. And a lot of the plastic that ends up in our oceans actually gets stuck in those. And that's what the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is.
Wow.
So there's these areas where plastics just get stuck.
The size of Texas? Is this what we've been hearing? Is the size of Texas?
Except there's one in every ocean, right? So every ocean, so there's one in the Atlantic, there's one in the Indian Ocean, the Arctic Ocean.
Pacific.
Everywhere. Yeah. So there's in every ocean, there's these accumulations of plastic. This sailing trip, it's going to take 2 years. I won't be on the boat itself for 2 years, But they're sailing around the world through all of those areas where plastics get stuck to try and understand more about the problem, the extent of the problem, looking at both microplastics, so that's the small bits of plastic that have broken down that you can barely see, but if you scoop up water through a filter, you can find these tiny fragments of plastics,
yep,
to the really big things, you know, your Coke bottles and your fishing nets and things like that that are floating around. And I applied to go on this voyage. It's 300 women, and I applied to do a leg. And so the 2 years are split up into 2 to 4 week legs.
Yep.
And I was successful in my application and went through this pretty extensive interview. Thanks. Yeah, pretty excited.
We can do fist bumps.
Went through this pretty extensive interview process, application process, and have been accepted to do on one of the legs that's in October next year. So
awesome.
October 2020. So I'll be flying to Mauritius, getting on the boat in Mauritius, and then we sail down to Reunion Island and then skirt the edge of the Indian Ocean plastic garbage patch, and then round the bottom of the Horn and
awesome.
To Cape Town.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah, so that's pretty exciting.
So when I think about this Perandere, you know, you're going to be near, you know, where you know, your people are.
My people.
Your people, the Peranderes.
Yes, actually. Yeah. Well, you know, it's actually really, it's kind of fun because there's an area between the two tropics, so, you know, Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, where I look like everybody else on the planet with my brown hair and my brown skin, which is a bit pale at the moment because winter in Queensland makes me a little bit grey. But, so it'll be fun to go to Mauritius and I'll probably look like every person in Mauritius.
Awesome. That's fantastic. I'm excited for it. You've actually got a whole heap of stuff going on.
Yeah.
You're super busy. You're super busy. I think that there's probably a tremendous amount of other podcasts that we could probably kick into and we could talk about. There's some things that, I was going to ask you since we're on the note of the expedition and the oceans and all that, but if I had to ask you, why is it so important right now, especially at this time, why is it so important to save our oceans?
So, I mean, there's a few reasons. The oceans are really the lungs of the planet. While the rainforests are incredibly important and they are the lungs of our planet too, ocean ecosystems process and capture more carbon than any other land-based ecosystem combined. So by protecting our coral reefs, we're actually pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. So without the oceans... you know, we all evolved. Every animal on this planet evolved out of the oceans, and so we are intrinsically linked ecologically and in terms of our genes back to the oceans. And if we don't take care of our oceans and our oceans perish, then we will perish too.
So in terms of that, and that's probably a simple answer, really, isn't it? And that's something you've been preaching and getting out there. Is that what you deliver to those kids too?
Probably not to that extent. That's a pretty negative message. I don't have children myself, and that's there's a few reasons for not having children and not wanting children. One of them is environmental. I think that we're handing the reins, the baton, to this next generation, and it's a really tatty baton. It's not looking good, and that's the generation. So our generation are having to come up with solutions, but they're the generation that are going to have to live in this world that we've created, that our previous generations have created. And I think we need to help them understand the situation, understand the problems, understand how to change things and how to make things better. And also, you often find that you can't actually change adults very well. Adults don't tend to want to change. They get set in their ways.
Stubborn.
I know, but you can change children's views. And right. children can then influence their parents because they put pressure on their parents. You know, if a child learns about recycling at home and you're not, and their parents aren't recycling, then the kids are going to actually go and say, hey, why aren't we recycling? We should be putting these bottles in this, you know, bin with the yellow top or whatever it might be. And that actually puts pressure on the parents to change their ways.
Yeah, so I was going to say, where does that start? That starts right there in the household, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah. You know, schools have a lot of influence. The education that kids receive at schools have a lot of influence on what they believe and what they understand. But a lot of, you know, you spend the first 18 years of your life believing what your parents believe, you know, so you don't question what your parents are telling you. So whether it's religious belief or political opinion or whatever it might be. So if your parents aren't recycling, then why would you think to recycle? Because that's what you know. That's all you know, you know.
And it seems like it's evolved over the last couple decades, recycling.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and you know what? It can always be better. Can definitely always be better.
Yeah, yeah.
Who do you support out there, in terms of from a charity aspect, or are there any organizations that you're gung ho about?
Look, I think there's a lot of organizations doing a lot of really great things. I think it's very difficult because the bigger an organization gets, the less your right. dollars actually reach the cause, because they become these big conglomerates that require money to run.
Yeah.
I actually personally prefer to microfinance.
Yep.
So I use a platform called Kiva.
Kiva.
K-I-V-A, kiva.org. And I've been using that now for almost 12 years, I think. And I lend $25 at a time to people in the developing world who are looking to, expand or start a business or fund their education. I just gave a loan last week, actually, to a guy who's at university in Uganda.
Wow.
Who is wanting to study business so that he can actually make a better life for himself and his family. And I think that that's incredibly rewarding thing to be part of, because you ultimately will get your money back. And even if they default or you don't get all of it back because of the exchange rate, and it's $25, you know. Well, it's $25 to you or I. It's not a handout.
Right.
It's a loan.
It's a small micro. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's small loans, people who otherwise wouldn't have access to finance, and they actually want to do something that makes a difference to their lives and other people's lives.
And it's such a small amount, and they know how to do it based on their current economy and place where they're at.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I like to do things that way, because I don't think that just handing things to people solves a problem. You know, I think you really need to help lift people out of those situations.
So, one other thing that I'll talk about, and then obviously there might be people out there that go, hey, how do we get a hold of Gemma?
Oh yeah.
We want to know how to get a hold of Gemma, because we'd like to either speak to her. That is if you want to be contactable after this. But I noticed that on your Facebook page, this is something I've seen on LinkedIn. I've read articles about it. I see it, you know, all the time, and people mention it, is about imposter syndrome. You put something out there about imposter syndrome, and before you answer, I see somebody who's super capable and has achieved quite a bit over the last decade and traveled quite a bit. And you know, it's kind of exciting to see your trajectory as to where you're going and where you continue to keep going. So can you tell me why you put that article out there?
Yeah, look, I suffer immensely from imposter syndrome. It's actually, while most people, particularly people who are in academic circles, do suffer from imposter syndrome, it's really common amongst women. Most women suffer from imposter syndrome.
Why do you think that is?
Look, I think a lot of professions still have a long way to go in terms of equality and equity when it comes to gender. Certainly science and engineering, the fields that I operate in, are still stuck in the dark ages when it comes to gender equality and diversity. There's still what we call a leaky pipeline in the science, technology, engineering, mathematics.
The STEM community.
Yeah, the STEM community. So It's very common to have at least, you know, 50-50 graduation in terms of gender from university in the sciences and engineering and other STEM fields. And then somewhere along the line, you've only got about 2% of women actually in senior management positions in those fields. And we call it the leaky pipeline. And a lot of it is because I don't feel that there's the flexibility or the opportunity for women. There's certainly still a glass ceiling for women in those fields, and that's something I'm really passionate about, is, you know, breaking stereotypes. And we talked about it earlier, that I'm not the kind of person that just sits and takes it from somebody. I will give it back as hard as I receive it. And so, you know, I think it's important that we pull people up on sexist comments or inappropriate comments, and I do it. I'm not afraid to do it. But imposter syndrome is something that definitely impacts women more, because it's a confidence issue. And it's self-belief as much as anything else. And I don't think that women are as supported, and, you know, women tend to have a lot of self-confidence issues generally, I think. And, you know, men do too, but I think, you know, women are riddled with self-doubt. And I am no different. You know, I sometimes feel like I'm just making it up as I go along, or do I really know enough about this topic to be talking about it? You know, that I'm not really anything special. I actually don't really think I'm anything that special, to be honest. I just think I'm your average person just trying to do something in the world. So, and I think that it's important, because social media paints this picture that, you know, and I know this because people have made comments to me in the past that I live this charmed life of international travel and success and, you know, all of the qualifications and the things I get to do and the projects I get to work on and the opportunities that come my way. But the reality is that I have as much self-doubt as the next person, and I struggle with it immensely sometimes. You know, I sometimes feel like I'm not good enough to be doing what I'm doing, and, you know, that somewhere along the line someone's going to work out that I don't deserve to be where I am or doing what I'm doing. And it's something that, you know, I have to, there's a lot of self-talk that I have to do. I probably am my hardest critic.
I was going to ask you, what is it you're doing right now? What strategy do you have in place to be able to say, God, I got that feeling. I need to overcome this. This is a little bit of a obstacle. I need to change my thought pattern right now. And
yeah,
I'm a perandere, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. Well, first of all, perandere is never quit. That's
ooh, that's there we thing, go.
Right? That's a well-known fact.
Yeah.
Is that, and actually, if you talk to a perandere, they will tell you that perandere is never quit.
Cool.
So, but jokes aside, I've always just pushed through. So I tend to kind of recognize and acknowledge the thought. I sort of say, okay, you know, it's the same when I'm running an ultra marathon. You acknowledge that your toe hurts, you know, or your finger hurts, or your foot hurts. You know, you acknowledge it. You recognize it. You don't ignore it. You just allow it to hurt. And it's the same, like, I have those thoughts of self-doubt and being an imposter. And I allow those thoughts to come and then go. And I, you know, try and lift myself up by, I talk to myself. Maybe that's a sign of madness.
That's the best thing. How many times you've been in the car? When I'm in the car and I'm driving, that's what I'm doing. I'm like, all right, Jared, let's go. What are we doing? And I'm like, I'm a one-man party when I'm by myself.
Yeah. And, you know, I live alone, and I spend a lot of time with other people, you know, at work and, you know, running and whatever. But I also spend quite a lot of time alone, even as an extrovert. You know, I like to have my time alone. And that's the time where I actually, you know, kind of reconcile with myself. I work out where I am, what I need to do. I try and kind of get my head back in the right space. And if I'm feeling a bit overwhelmed, I allow myself just to have a break. You know,
yeah.
I think I've gotten to a point where I've burnt out before. I've gone too hard and I've burnt out. And I've recognized that if you don't cut yourself some slack sometimes, you just have to, you know, you just have to, you're going to break if you don't allow yourself to do that. But I think it's important that people know that it's not easy, you know?
Yeah.
Like, social media paints this magical picture of everything. Nobody puts crap things on social media, you know? Like, I'm not putting a picture of me washing my underwear in a hotel sink. Like, that's a really crappy image anyway, because you don't want to see my bottoms. But aside from that, you know, like, you're not putting the crap stuff up on social media, you know. Living out of a suitcase for 5.5 weeks or 6 weeks is a pretty miserable experience, and it's hard. But at the same time, you know, I'm so grateful for those opportunities.
Yeah.
But I just think it's important that people understand that it's not all sunshine and rainbows, you know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It comes back to that point, you know. Like I used to hear, you know, if you succeed in life without making any sacrifices, that means somebody else sacrificed for you. Mm. And so you're constantly making these sacrifices. Sometimes people don't see it. They don't want to show them, you know, they don't want to show those nasty bits of life or to how you got there.
Yeah.
But I think that it's important that you share.
Yeah.
You definitely share and that, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, human. Life is full of sacrifices. You know, you don't choose to be successful in one part of your life and then just win at everything else, you know. I think I've made some pretty big sacrifices and really put my neck out on the line to get to where I am.
Yeah, very cool. I appreciate you sharing all that. What I was going to say, Gemma, for the wider audience out there, if you had, you know, a piece of advice moving forward on the environment that you would want to share with the wider audience, what is it that you could share with them in terms of how to help the environment right now? One simple strategy.
Educate yourself. Don't just go to a single source of information. Make sure that you're getting a really broad range of information and learn. And ask questions. It's okay to ask questions. There's plenty of people out there who do know a lot about environmental issues and various things that relate to the environment. Ask questions. Be inquisitive, learn, explore, and even the smallest change can make a huge difference.
Awesome. Gemma Parandare, thank you very much for being on the Attitude Series.
Thank you.
You rock.
Thanks.